You're listening to INRE from Control Risks, the global specialist risk consultancy. Each episode of INRE features insights from experts across the world into the most complex issues facing legal and compliance professionals today.
Welcome to Dispute Diaries, a podcast exploring the world of disputes and investigations, which is part of the INRE series of podcasts hosted by Control Risks. In this episode, we're going to talk about India and disputes leading to and out of India, which is emerging as a more and more important market as the days go by and the geopolitical situation gets more and more complex. We have two guest speakers with us today, Pratik Bagaria, the partner at Singularity Legal, who heads Singularity Legal's global business. Pratik has experience in complex disputes and arbitration matters spanning the globe, and he's here to provide us with a view of how disputes are evolving, particularly with a focus on the UAE and Switzerland. Hello, Pratik. Welcome to the podcast.
Hi, Akash. Thank you for having me. Very excited for the next few hours.
Great, Pratik. Thanks for being here and joining us. And with me also today is Mike Harrington, who leads our business intelligence and disputes practice in India. Mike is based in Mumbai and leads on disputes work in India and across South Asia. Hi, Mike. How are you?
Hi, Akash. Good to be here with you. Thanks for having me.
Cheers. Thanks, Mike. Welcome to the pod. So let's dive right in. Pratik, do you want to tell us a bit more about yourself and, you know, how you're seeing the India-focused disputes market really evolving? You know, what's been your experience in your practice? I'd love to hear from you.
Thanks, Akash. So just as a quick introduction, I'm an international dispute lawyer. We are one of the few firms in the region who are internationally focused, which means our disputes are not geographically tied to India or Indian law. Gives us a very exciting spread of work, as you mentioned in the beginning of your call. But India, of course, is a strong focus. You know, we have a large team back in Mumbai, and one of the key segments, I would say, is to serve India-related international disputes. I would say 20% of our work today has an India element, which makes it very exciting jurisdiction for the firm. The kind of work is a mixed bag. I would say what comes to us is generally disputes with an international character. So there are the disputes coming inwards, which is foreign companies, foreign nationals having disputes with Indian company, Indian nationals. I would say from a jurisdiction perspective, if you have to consider the last couple of years, the traffic from Russia is very interesting. You know, since there has been sanctions globally for Russian businesses, they've started levitating a lot of business towards India. Mm-hmm. And that is seeing interesting disputes coming in with Russian parties, which are happening against Indian counterparts. So that's been a pretty interesting, you know, set of work. And it also ties in with the jurisdictions you want to talk about today, because what we are seeing is, of course, a lot of Russian companies and parties have become UAE resident or are operating out of UAE.
Yeah.
And there are a lot of standard clauses they had historically adopted, which take them to Swiss arbitration. So there is a lot of this combination which is coming out from the Russian market towards India. But at the same time, the old disputes and businesses remain. For example, Singapore companies is a big segment of disputes which come in with Indian parties. Mm-hmm. It's either because global companies establish their Southeast Asia, South Asia headquarters in Singapore, or there are several Singapore companies who are trying to explore local markets in India. And that's led to a series of cases. Of course, the Japanese and the Koreans are always on the forefront of bringing engineering, construction, mm-hmm. and other such related disputes into the market, you know, when it comes to the power plants, or whether it comes to shipbuilding and breaking, or whether it comes to engineering, etc. Of course, the American companies is a big market, and some of the big disputes when it comes to foreign disputes with Indian parties come with American conglomerates, be it, you know, the airline industry, be it oil and gas, be it telecom, be it private equity. And then, of course, Europe plays a decent role. I would say especially Central Europe comes in with a lot of very interesting disputes in the Indian market. We are seeing a lot in the space of outdoor advertising, or when it comes to engineering, or when it comes to oil and gas specific technical engineering related stuff. I think Central Europe still plays a very interesting market. Of course, I would say being in UAE, when you talk about inwards dispute into India, we're seeing a lot of disputes coming in now from UAE, especially after the reciprocity issue was solved between UAE and India. So just to give you that background, you know, UAE judgments can now be enforced in India as if they are Indian judgments.
Okay.
And that's led to a big take of enforcement work coming in. So that's generally the kind of work I would say is coming inwards to India, but that's not the end of the work we are seeing. We're seeing a lot of work going outside India. Indian conglomerates have become multinationals. They have disputes in pretty much all forums in the world. They may be not Indian company, but it's Indian owned, foreign subsidiaries of several Indian conglomerates in the Middle East, especially. You would see Saudi Arabia has a big Indian diaspora working there. Mm-hmm. You would also see this happening in Dubai. You would also see this happening in Qatar and other jurisdictions, which is a big Indian market. And of course, Indian companies have historically been involved in the US market, which leads to a lot of interesting cases. In the recent years, we've seen big class action happening against essentially Indian companies for products supplied in the US markets. Of course, UK is a place you've seen Indian companies doing. And I would say that the last good segment is the Indian financial industry, which is lending these Indian businesses overseas. Mm-hmm. They have given a big chunk of international disputes. There's a lot of cross-border default, which is happening. We've seen cases where, banks are needing counsel to chase 15, 18 jurisdictions across for debtors who have run away with substantial capital. And those are the exciting offshore projects which have come in originally, essentially coming from an India Connect. So I would say it's a pretty wide spectrum. The market is finally as mature as you would see it to be in other jurisdictions. You can exclusively run an international dispute practice and not be concerned about it. Of course, this was the exact debate which I used to have when I started Singularity, where I was told that, can a firm like this originate from India and survive? And today I feel it can survive and more. The kind of work which is there in the region is just significantly large. So that's roughly the kind of work we do, which is India focused.
No, thanks, Prateek. I think that feeds into my experience as well, because when I started doing asset tracing related to Indian disputes back in 2014, the mandates were mainly still focused within the borders of the country. And when we'd go to clients and say, look, we need to look outside, there wasn't the appetite that there is today to actually explore enforcement and asset tracing, outside India. And, as you said, work in India typically does lead to the Middle East, especially the UAE and the free zones. And from there on, to the rest of the world. So that's a very good point. Thanks. Mike, you're in Mumbai. Is your experience in line with what Prateek is saying? Is there anything you'd like to add to that?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, there is definitely a noticeable uptick in work that we see involving Indian parties, on either side of the dispute. And to your point, Akash, referencing some years ago when you were doing this work in India and the asset tracing being kind of confined to the borders of India, what I noticed in that era that you referenced, which is around the time that I moved to India, was that a lot of the Indian companies, as you said, were sort of focused on assets within the borders, but also the international clients that I had who had disputes with Indian counterparties were really focused outside the borders of India. They weren't really interested in looking to enforce in India itself. The perception was that enforcement was too hard. The courts were too slow. Assets were too hard to find. And I think that the availability and our ability to find the assets, while it may have improved a little since then, it hasn't improved significantly. It was actually not that bad back then. It's just that we didn't have a lot of clients from overseas really pursuing that. But now we're seeing an uptick in a far more global approach, where the international counterparties who are going after assets held by Indian debtors are interested in enforcing in India. To Pratik's point, the reciprocity now with the UAE obviously gives a lot more power to companies with judgments in the UAE to enforce in India. But also it seems that parties coming from all directions trying to enforce judgments in arbitration centers all over the world are interested in looking in India itself. And I've been sort of hearing from lawyers here that the pace of the Indian court system has actually improved in the last several years. I also think that there is just generally a more sophisticated, more mature approach to disputes in the Indian market on all sides, particularly with Indian law firms and you know, the way that they kind of advise their clients in India to think about asset tracing. You know, occasionally I used to get some counsel recommend me for a global asset search when trying to enforce judgments elsewhere around the world. But oftentimes that kind of service that we would provide was perceived as kind of, you know, throwing good money after bad. And now we're seeing that that everyone is a bit more sophisticated because people have been doing this for longer. And to Pratik's point about, you know, the maturation of the market globally, and in particularly in places like Singapore, you know, SIAC has really ramped up, you know, its presence with India. A significant part of its portfolio is now India-related disputes. Mm-hmm. And so we're seeing a lot more pipeline coming out of Singapore, as well as some of these other markets that Pratik mentioned.
Yeah, thanks for that, Mike. I think you're right. And even in my experience, the market has evolved, like you said. And, you know, there seems to be a more commercial, but also slightly more broad-minded approach nowadays to asset tracing, enforcement and disputes work. So that's good. I mean, Pratik, I want to pull you back to the point about disputes benefiting from the mutual recognition that the UAE offers now in India. And to Mike's point about, you know, Indian companies now wanting to look overseas as well. Pratik, in your experience, do you think that Indian companies have more success at home rather than in international markets when it comes to disputes, or more specifically when it comes to arbitration-related matters? Are they, you know, still looking at the home market, or are they now willing to consider, you know, arbitration centers further than maybe the UAE and just Singapore, which is what we normally talk about?
Well, it's a question which may not have a perfect answer, and you know, it all depends on which way you slice the paper. I think it's a very industry-specific question, and the answer will differ from industry to industry. Let's say, for example, you talk about the shipping and trading guys. They have naturally always chosen something like England or now Singapore, which is just naturally there because that's where the industry is. And you wouldn't want, you know, disputes of those natures to go in various other places. Dubai has been much lesser a choice for Indian parties. And I think it's because there is some confusion on whether awards from Dubai can be enforced against Indian parties in India. So some people have, you know, reservations, and there is no clarity on where the law is on that. So a foreign party generally says no to a Dubai arbitration. But when it comes to industries like shipping, England and Singapore is pretty much open, shipping and trade. But when you look at things like construction, if you're the employer, you know, if there are foreign companies coming to do a project in India, it's natural that they are going to be seated in India. We've seen a trend that rules of international institutions are appointed. So there is the one of the employers who's building something in the rail sector in India has naturally chosen the ICC clause for their standard contract, and they're doing a yellow book. But they are still seated in India. It's not that they're seating those. Sorry?
What's a yellow book?
So the yellow book is a FIDIC book for standardized contracts, which you use in the construction industry.
Okay.
So they are giving these standardized contracts, which take you back to the ICC. So they're retaining those ICC clauses, but again, they're seated in India. But when it comes to everyday businessman, right, when you're talking of private equity investments and when you're talking about M&A and JVs, I think seats are going much more abroad. So you will see Singapore, of course, naturally as the largest chosen seat. It used to be England first. That also used to be France. But there are still certain big Indian family houses or global corporations who have used certain jurisdictions historically, and they stick to that. Mm-hmm. So we have a few clients who have had a London or a French-seated arbitration, Paris-seated arbitration for more than two decades, and I think they are very comfortable to stick to that and not move to the Singapore. But I would say it generally revolves around common law jurisdictions. But of course, there are the outliers, and you know, we are seeing everything, right? Today, especially Indian clients in Africa are seating their disputes in Africa. You know, we have cases where Rwanda is the seat of arbitration. We have cases where, you know, there are more exotic places which people have chosen. Mauritius is a very often choice because you get a tax residency certificate if you seat your arbitration in Mauritius. So it's very beneficial for certain parties to use their PPM, private placement memorandum in the funds industry to put in a Mauritius clause and seat the dispute there. So as I said, the answer can't be one, but what I can definitely tell you is we've serviced Indian parties in mostly all arbitral institutions across the globe. So the point is they are there in all institutions. I won't feel if you pick up a checklist of certain prominent arbitrations and you try to find Indian parties, you won't find them.
Yeah. No, that makes sense. I mean, I want to try and pin you down in the UAE and Switzerland a bit more, Prateek. You know, you mentioned that, you know, it's hard to give a definite answer because it's such a broad brush, right? And some sectors and some business houses have historically preferred some seats compared to others. Can you tell us why the UAE and Switzerland play such a key role in Indian disputes overseas? Are there any particular types of clients or sectors which prefer to be seated there? Or, you know, what's your experience? I'd love to hear from you.
So Switzerland, of course, at least from my perspective, I don't think my personal experience is that our practice sees a lot of Indian disputes in Switzerland, right?
Okay.
What we are seeing, of course, is in the recent years, we are seeing a lot of disputes in Switzerland. Mm-hmm. But I would say that phenomena is the uptake of Russian work, what we are doing in the Middle East market, right? And I think that's taking us time and again. I would say right now we are looking at 14 arbitrations, which are running in different parts of Switzerland. Mm-hmm. So, you know, Indian parties, yes and no. I would say they do end up going to Switzerland for certain places. But I think where Switzerland becomes interesting is recovery against Indian parties. Mm-hmm. So what we've seen is Indian parties love Swiss bank. If you have an Indian millionaire or a billionaire, there is this natural tendency of feeling that your money is safe in the Swiss bank. And it's for good reasons. There are these wealthy individuals who have, you know, been using the Swiss banking system since a long period of time. And, you know, we've chased a lot of second generation billionaires. We've chased second generation multimillionaires or third generation, you know, billionaires, multimillionaires. And historically, you'll see from the 60s, 70s, 80s, there has been a trend of Indian rich houses and families using England as a place to live and Switzerland as a place to keep their money.
Yeah.
So when you're chasing an Indian individual, we more often than not find ourselves in Switzerland, you know, no matter where we are coming to chase him from, but there will be that Swiss bank account. There will be a Julius Baer or there will be a Credit Suisse or there will be a, you know, one of those banks is handling their money. And the other reason you see this is because Swiss banks have done an excellent job of capturing the private wealth industry in the Middle East.
Right.
So what you see is the Indian millionaire or billionaire are migrating to the Middle East and then giving their wealth to Swiss managers sitting back in Switzerland. So you had Bank of Saracen, which went down, but you know, it did a lot of money for Indian clients. You have the Credit Suisse. You have you know, Julius Baer is something you see a lot of new age Indian millionaires interacting with. I think it's just a status symbol, I would say, in Dubai to let Julius Baer handle your money, right? It's reached that stage of the parties and the events and the social gatherings in which you get participate by letting your wealth being managed in that circle. So I think that definitely leads you a lot to Switzerland. And we often tell clients who are chasing Indian billionaires or millionaires to say, let's get some investigation done in Switzerland because we're going to find something there, right? We're going to find some trace. And why it's interesting is because, you know, Swiss attachment is pretty easy. You can just march in and say, I have a claim. I don't even need a decision. And if I can attach something on it, I can attach. So it's a very quick and easy process. So far as UAE is concerned, I think you are correct to say that the market of Indian disputes is significant. I would say, so I, you know, as an individual practitioner and as a firm, we focus a lot on Singapore, right? We have an office there. We spend a lot of our dispute work happens in Singapore. And you would generally see the numbers are high when it comes to the Singapore market. SIAC does 50% of its caseload from India, right? That's a large number of disputes to have from one jurisdiction. Or SICC, the top disputes have been Indian disputes, at Kiri Industry, for example. Or even the Singapore court, the landmarks are coming out of big Indian arbitrations, right? You have Anupam Mittal as a good example, and you have Amazon going. So it's definitely servicing Indian market, and you hear a lot. But when you go to UAE, you realize that Singapore is actually a very small operator compared to UAE-India relation. Because though they are no longer having an Indian company identity, they've become a UAE company, they're essentially Indian. Yeah. A lot of big players in the Middle East are essentially running from Indian businessmen. And you will see them in the DIFC court. If you pick up the DIFC roster today, you'll be surprised of how many disputes belong to Indian defendants or claimants there, or how many Indian banks are actually litigating in the DIFC courts. Same, for example, DIAC. Today, if you ask DIAC to disclose their India number, I was having this informal chat with some people involved, and they said, if we start publishing those numbers, it's going to be a big chunk showing that there is India connection. So UAE has naturally been the business partner. I don't know if you know, before the dollarization of United Arab Emirates, the only currency which was exchangeable with the UAE currency was the Indian rupee. So it was pegged on the Indian rupee from the 1970, which meant historically there is this business relationship. Of course, then the new age businesses came in from the 95s and the 2000s, but a huge diaspora of UAE, I would say 65 to 70% population of Dubai is Indians.
Yeah.
So of course, with that, naturally, India disputes is in every segment of UAE.
That's interesting. Thanks, Pratik. I mean, you know, you're drawing a distinction between why these two markets are important. UAE being because Indians are based there and running businesses there historically, you know, far before national borders look the way they do today on the world map. And, you know, disputes from there would typically lead asset tracers like us to Switzerland simply because, you know, the money's there. And as you say, you know, it's not like Swiss banks are becoming redundant. They're becoming more like status symbols, right? Where you flash your Julius Baer card and that's something you want your friends and business associates to see. Mike, what are you seeing? Are you seeing much work heading to, I mean, the UAE, obviously, but, you know, how much of your work is heading to Switzerland and how many cases have you worked on recently where there's, you know, a significant Swiss angle?
Yeah, I mean, there's often an angle that leads us to one of these places that Pratik is talking about, whether it's Switzerland, Mauritius, the UAE. And, you know, when we're doing asset tracing in particular, I often think about how we have to, when we're dealing with Indian counterparties, we have to inquire locally to trace assets globally. And that's because we often don't find the Swiss bank account or the UAE presence or the Mauritius presence just from some cursory or, you know, kind of high level desktop research or even in depth research. It's really when we actually talk to human sources in India who are familiar with the millionaires and billionaires that Pratik is talking about, you know, the people that are from their hometowns, the people that are from their community in India, the people that have done business with them for years or decades, and you know, sources who have scrutinized them and investigated them in the past. Those are the people that will give us some of those leads that bring us to the UAE, that bring us to Switzerland. So I think, you know, what Pratik is talking about really resonates because, you know, we often start our investigation in India and then it spreads all over the world. It's kind of like this spider web. It sort of shoots out from here and takes us to Singapore, to the UAE, to Switzerland, to Malta, to the Caribbean, and so on and so forth, to the United States and the UK. The list goes on and on. This, you know, talking about Switzerland did remind me of an interesting story. There was one investigation I did for an Indian client where instead of finding the money, we were trying to actually stop the money. The situation was that the Indian company had been defrauded and convinced to transfer money out of India to two separate entities, one in Hong Kong and one in none other than Switzerland. And once they realized the mistake they had made, they needed to get a court order to stop the money from leaving the bank account in India as it was about to be wired overseas. So we were racing against the clock. And the ask of me and my team was to try to find enough information or do enough work on the Hong Kong and Switzerland entity to come up with a sort of a reasonable conclusion that they don't have assets. Basically, you know, go and look really hard so that you don't find something. Of course, they were hoping we wouldn't find something, and we didn't. So we were able to show that we've done this extensive work on these entities, and we found that they don't appear to have any assets. They're just shell companies that have been set up to receive this money that they're receiving fraudulently. And that was enough to kind of, you know, go to the court and say, look, you know, we need to get an order to freeze this money from leaving the shores of India. But certainly our work takes us to all of these places at some point or another.
Now that's brilliant. I think another facet of investigations in India nowadays and how they've evolved is what Pratik touched upon, saying, you know, the new age millionaires and billionaires. Firstly, there's a lot of new money in India. Secondly, I think offshoring your money and your corporate interests has, for lack of a better term, been democratized. Because earlier you'd need to have, you know, a certain amount of wealth and a certain amount of foreign connections to be able to move your money and hold offshore bank accounts, offshore structures, and structure a company that way. Pratik, correct me if I'm wrong, but, you know, nowadays, literally every investigation we touch seems to have this. And, you know, the numbers don't have to be in the hundreds of millions. They can be in the low millions. And it's just so much easier to move money and set up offshore structures, yeah?
Well, yes, easier is a better term than easy.
Easier,
I would compare it to the 90s versus today, right? So I think obviously the ODI regulations have opened up quite a bit, and overseas joint venture regulations have opened quite a bit. But there is also this ability to migrate out. And if you see in the last 10 years, India has seen a large millionaire, billionaire migration outside the country. Yeah. So, of course, yes, all those factors together make you lead outside. But as you rightly said, it's simply a lot of wealth which has come in to the nation, right? We are the third largest number of billionaires in the world today. We weren't there 20 years back. Of course, whether the wealth is distributed equally and fairly is a debate for another time, but there is wealth. There is no question that there is a significant uptake of wealthy individuals. And that's definitely seen what you're saying, right? Nothing stops within the boundaries of India. Because today, if you're making money and doing well in India, you're naturally seen to migrate outside India and have an ecosystem somewhere in Dubai or somewhere in London or somewhere in Singapore or New York or LA or somewhere in the big cities, which are global players of business or fashion or style. So definitely, every Indian investigation should have an international outlook.
Yeah, I completely echo that point, Pratik. You know, to kind of circle back to centers of arbitration, which you touched upon briefly earlier, the view from Dubai, you know, I'd love to get your thoughts on this. You know, what's your perspective on the rise of arbitration centers in India? You know, you have the centers in Mumbai, Delhi, Hyderabad, and other cities as well coming up. Do, you know, you see clients preferring to have a clause to seat the arbitration there? Or, you know, what's been your experience so far?
So I think the way to approach this question is to see, are the clients choosing any rules compared to the monopoly of ad hoc arbitration? So India still today, the battle is not between the institutions, but it's between no institution and an institution. So whichever rules people choose, it at least brings in that, okay, there is a institutional mindset in the client, and the client has realized that an institutional arbitration is better than ad hoc, right? And if you ask me this question, definitely there is a mindset change compared to, say, a decade back, the amount of institutional arbitration clauses which existed versus now. There is simply no compare. I would say 1 out of 10 were institutional a decade back. 5 out of 10 would be institutional today, right?
Wow, so that's a huge growth. Huh?
It's simply become a competitor to ad hoc arbitration, right? But again, since it's India, every demographic depends on where you're cutting the line from, right? But if you see the local market in India, they are still very ad hoc arbitration driven, right? So this number would work when you talk about international trade and commerce. It might even start tilting more towards institutional arbitration. But when it comes to Indian-to-Indian arbitration, that's not been somewhere where institutional arbitration has picked up. And I think the institutions which have come within the country are playing for that cake. And I think they are not, in a sense, competing with the LCIAs and SIACs and the other institutions in the world. Take, for example, the Mumbai Metro, right? The Mumbai Metro has seen significant amount of reference to the MCIA. That's created a good amount of workload.
The Mumbai Center of International Arbitration.
Yes, right? The Mumbai Center for International Arbitration. Yes, absolutely. Yeah. And there has also been a trend, without commenting on the legality of it or whether it should happen or not, and especially because I am in a mix of this issue before the DIFC court, so I don't want to comment anything for my other side to understand what I think on it. But
if they listen to this podcast,
I believe so. I hope so.
I'm sure they do. They must.
Yeah. Wait, they're waiting for Pratik to trip up.
but to tell you what the Indian courts are doing is they are in arbitrations which don't have an institutional clause, appointing an institution. So the Supreme Court has recently given several orders where in an international arbitration, they would tell parties, I'm appointing this arbitrator, appear before this institution. Now, you know, it may sound odd to some, but it is happening, and it's happening orders after orders. So that's, again, channeling people towards institutions. So there is, of course, this growth of domestic institutions being done. But I would still say when you compare this segment, the choice of ad hoc to domestic will still be 2 out of 10 or 1.5 out of 10, right? So I think it's not right to say whether Indian institutions are taking away business from international institutions. I think they are not competing. I think the right question is whether Indian institutions are taking business away from ad hoc arbitration. And I would say that they've still not scratched the surface as deeply as it could. But the growth of these institutions, like as you rightly said, Hyderabad and Delhi and Mumbai, and there are many more across, would definitely create that ecosystem where parties start doing institutional arbitration over ad hoc. And that will be a big victory in itself.
Absolutely. It's kind of formalizing an informal sector, so to say, right? Because moving from ad hoc to even, you know, more formalized domestic centers is still a move in the right direction.
No, absolutely. And it's, I think it's much needed because today, I know Mike did start this by saying that there is a increase in speed of Indian litigation. I won't be so hopeful for the audience. There isn't any to my knowledge.
I was going to say, I was quite surprised to hear that.
Yeah, I am surprised myself. I haven't been before Indian courts in some time, but I'm surprised to hear that. I don't think that's a sentiment which is everywhere, especially I would say Bombay is a very difficult jurisdiction to litigate right now, and it works as a snail's pace. Delhi is no better, so it's not right up there. But if you take institutional arbitration, you get out of that as much as you can, right? At least basic things like appointment of arbitrator and interim measures and such other challenges can easily go before an institution. Instead of waiting for, say, 8 months for the Supreme Court to appoint an arbitrator in your case, right? You know, we've seen cases where appointment of arbitrator application was filed in 2021 and the arbitrator got appointed in 2023. And you've spent 2 years in getting an arbitrator appointed, right? Where the entire arbitration would otherwise have been over and the award would have been delivered if you were with an institution. So I think it's definitely necessary to unburden the courts with, you know, applications like appointment of arbitrator. It's something which is not rocket science, or, you know, interim measures in arbitration. And that's why a move to institution arbitration is going to be a much welcome change for the arbitration scene in India.
Oh, that's great. Thanks for your thoughts on that. You know, lots to think about. Mike, are you seeing a growth in any work coming in from Indian seated arbitration? I haven't seen any so far, so I'd like to get your views on that.
Yeah, not yet. For us, what comes across my desk is still coming from kind of the traditional players, SIAC, Singapore International Arbitration Center, being number one, LCIA and other international players in the mix as well. But, you know, being in the market and speaking with people and speaking a lot with the legal fraternity here, there does seem to be a lot of excitement for the arbitration centers that are coming up. A lot of people are, you know, quite invested in it, you know, quite keen to see India grow as a center of arbitration in general. Lots of debates about, you know, when that will really happen, like when that will really blossom, and you know, how ready these institutions are for it. But people tend to be pretty optimistic. But some of these folks are the same ones that are telling me that the courts are moving a little faster than they used to. So, you know, optimism is always a you know, a key to sort of forward-looking success here.
Yeah, I mean, where would we be without optimism? But I think you need to check your sources a bit more closely, Mike. So that's really helpful. I think, you know, any discussion around Indian disputes, arbitration in India can't be complete without asking the lawyer on the call, in this case, you, Prateek, about what they make about the Indian Bar Association's decision to allow foreign law firms entry into the Indian market. How is that being viewed? I'd love your views on that.
Is there such decision? Are foreign law firms allowed in the market?
I don't know.
Well, I guess it's one of those. Allowing someone to do something which they don't want to do is not allowing anything, right? So
that's a very good way to put it. That's a very good way to put it, because all the lawyers I speak to in London say the same thing. You know, everyone's quite nervous and tiptoeing around it.
Yeah. No, it's I don't need your permission to service foreign clients in a foreign market, right? And I'm not going to come to India and be subject to 35 to 40% taxation for servicing my foreign client on foreign law. So it's not even a concession, and it will be very difficult to overstep. I think even this regulation, which was absolutely a concession, has gone back to the courts. It's under challenge before the Delhi High Court, and the courts asked tough questions of how can you overstep AK Balaji, which is already a Supreme Court judgment, which has come down heavily. So yes, I think that the mafia still controls the legal profession in the country and inhibits its growth to a direction where it could go. You know, Akash, you've been in the Indian consulting market for a time, and you'll realize from the earlier days to now why the Indian consulting market took a boom to where it was is because you allowed foreign consulting firms to come into the market.
Yes.
And you had the foreign auditors come in and the McKinsey's come in. And it didn't take away work. It created an interesting segment of work. It also created a competitive environment. It also raised the standard on which people are working in the market. And now you have guys like Mike who are working for, you know, an international consulting firm within India. So doing that for the legal industry is essential. If you don't do that, you're going to see a brain drain, which is continuously happening outside the country. And you will never grow a crop which is of an international standard, right? When you just mentioned something a while ago that, you know, Mike, that, you know, India wants to be an international arbitration center, you know. You know, VK Raja recently, a judge from the Singapore court, he came and gave a speech in India and he said, if you really want to be an international arbitration center, first improve your education system, improve how your people are trained, and once they are trained, how they're employed to deliver the work, and get more accountability in your existing legal system. Now, till you don't bring international players, neither of this is going to happen. And you are going to remain where you are, and you're not going to be an international seat of arbitration, because naturally, just take an example. I know Singapore is a small data point. Why the market is successful is because lawyer trained in Singapore is top-notch quality. And then he goes to local firms of international character or international firms of international character, and he sees it grow. And then he is of international standard and candor, and the judges are paid at an international standard to resolve international dispute, and it brings in the ecosystem. So my thought on what the Bar Council did is it should do definitely more. I think legislative intervention is necessary. Bar Council support is definitely necessary. The court support is necessary, because without it, it's only going to remain a dream. It's not going to be something which is achievable to overturn where the direction of the Indian legal market goes. But whatever they've done, the little step, great. But I don't think it's even a drop in the ocean to make any serious impact or interest for any foreign firms to come into the local market. There's no incentive to come in the local market.
And can I just ask, how likely do you think it is that there will be further developments that will actually liberalize this further, to the extent that you say is necessary for this to really mature? I mean, I remember, you know, coming to India beginning about 11, 12 years ago. And, you know, this idea of letting in foreign law firms was being talked about then as though it was right around the corner. Then, of course, it would be another decade before, you know, even just the slightest bit of movement was made. How do you feel about the prospects of this happening?
Well, you know, at the expense of ditching my entire fraternity, I would say that, you know, the Indian bar is quite protective. I don't know why. I've not been able to understand it. You know, I think they are extremely capable lawyers and law firms with large practices and sizes, and they can really play field with the foreign firms. But there is some sort of fear or psychosis in the general, either the law firm community or the lawyer community, that entry of foreign players would be counterproductive to what they are doing. And this general sentiment is majority currently. I think till that sentiment doesn't change, even if you were to make legislative amends, you would only see challenges after challenges in court, and there would be concessions and discounts, and there would be resistance to the opening of the market. So I think, especially with the, you know, how important is lawyers' contribution to elections, I don't think any government can really take very, very extreme and bold decisions here. And they always, you know, the Indian legislature is always very careful in abridging lawyers' rights because we are the first ones to go and challenge petitions and reach the Supreme Court with it. They haven't been able to get around how to appoint judges yet. So I think letting foreign firms come in is a far further step, and it will require a lot of political dialogue and diplomatic conversation between several people of interest. But again, you know, there are examples. For example, Dentons has done some very interesting structure and come into the market. If it stands the test of time, you'll see other players trying to use a Swiss Verein or brand share or other such modes and methods and try to come in. I think it's very, very brave on what they've done. And I think especially after the backlash with several players who were party to AK Balaji had, they took this decision to go ahead and structure it in the way they did. So let's see, you know, maybe there are structures available and law firms will come up with answers on how to bring it. I personally feel a Swiss Verein or a brand share is something which is not prohibited under any existing bar council regulations till you employ Indian lawyers to do work before Indian courts or advice on Indian law. So I don't think there are other restrictions, and the new law which has come in will at least let you register as a foreign lawyer and move to India to do things and practice. But again, these are only drops in the ocean, right? These are not how regulation should be. It's rather to adopt a Singapore or a Dubai approach and open the market, limited sense or a big sense, and get clarity to get business to thrive. Right?
Yeah, no, I think that's a good way of looking at it. I think my view on this, to be honest, is having grown up in India was always a very protectionist market, and it's taken a while to liberalize. Now, like Pratik said, every time there has been liberalization, the standard of that sector has been raised, right? I'll give you an example. Growing up, we had basically two brands of cars to choose from. You know, you either buy a Maruti or an Ambassador, right? There was no choice in the market. You know, if you were really wealthy, you'd import a foreign car, but otherwise your domestic choices were either two or three, and none of them were particularly good. Once that sector was opened up, right, not only did the car industry boom, it raised the standards and forced local manufacturers to improve their standards to match international players who are coming in. So now as a consumer, you have a wider choice, but you have a huge market which has attracted international players, increased the level of domestic expertise, domestic manufacturing, improved, you know, just the quality of the product, and more importantly, generated employment for hundreds of thousands of people. And it's the same with the professional consulting sector. You know, it's a sea change from when I started in India, and it's all thanks to international players coming in, bringing in international work and raising the standard across the board and giving opportunities to people there. So if this happens for the legal sector, I think it's a net positive, but that's my view. But it seems to be, you know, what Pratik is saying as well.
No, Akashan, you know, you're so right. And I'll just give you the example on why this makes sense, right? Today, if you pick up the top 100 global law firms, all have a very well-staffed India practice.
Yes.
They have enough Indians working on Indian law issues, dealing with Indian disputes or Indian deals or Indian M&A or Indian anything. But because you have these archaic outlook, that service is being taxed overseas. And yeah, that staff is being staffed overseas. Now, the minute you don't do that, that is going to happen in your cities. You know, it's going to happen, say, in Gift or in Mumbai or in Delhi or in Bangalore. And you suddenly see a bunch of high-paid lawyers pouring into your cities, who's going to buy better real estate and who's going to buy better entertainment and who's going to buy, just have that spending power of use and choice, which you're naturally going to see percolate into a financial center, right? So yes, it's a no-brainer. Just by not letting them in, you're not stopping them from doing it, right? And today I'm having Akash sit in London and do this. If you were more liberal of things happening, you might have been doing similar things sitting back down in India. Or, you know, for me, I am a lawyer practicing, you know, Indian qualified lawyer, but, you know, I'm practicing in DIFC or Singapore, is because I don't see that opportunity in the Indian market of getting that work done in the Indian court. So, you know, if you don't do that, you're going to have this impact on it, where your good cream or good work is going to be happening offshore while it would still be happening.
Yeah, no, that's a very good point. And you know, one that every listener should really consider. I think I'd like to end the podcast on you, Pratik, to try and, you know, we've talked about cross-border disputes. We've talked about the UAE, Switzerland, Singapore, you know, why these centers are, you know, are important and who goes there and why. Your practice spans all these jurisdictions. Can you give us a good war story, you know, which tries to touch upon, maybe not all, I think that's pushing it, but maybe, you know, some of the key countries and jurisdictions we spoke about?
I thought about this question of yours, and you know, it's like how to pick up your favorite child, right? I think every dispute as a lawyer, you're so invested in and you live it, right? You live it till it grows and you live it till it settles. Yeah. So very difficult. But I thought I'll talk about my favorite one currently. That's what the mother does, right? Whichever is the favorite one at the present time, you know, it's always good to tweak. And it's a very interesting case because it covers a lot of jurisdictions you spoke about, and it leaves a very bitter antidote for Indian dispute resolution behind as well. So I think it's a good story which ties in the entire conversation we had. So we're chasing an Indian national who has not much connection in the sense of business left to India. He has a lot of business interests in India, but he's a resident of the United Arab Emirates. And the dispute has nothing to do with India. It's about chasing a bunch of money, a significant bunch of money for businesses which were happening in the Middle East. My client's a Middle Eastern national and the other client is an Indian national, but the business has nothing to do whatsoever with India, right? It's an oil and gas enterprise spread out across several jurisdictions globally, maybe a small office somewhere in India, etc. And it's a debt recovery project. Effectively, I would say net is I need to collect money which is owed to me. Now, this project is interesting is because we did our investigation in this case and found assets in Cayman Island, Switzerland, Singapore, UAE. And that was where the net of the assets were, right? There were assets in India, but they were eventually held from Singapore or held from UAE or held from somewhere else. So I could go to the source, but I also could go to the root, right? So I had two options to really do this. And why it's interesting is it was one of the first cases which happened under the new DIAC rule. So I don't know if you know this, DIFC LCIA was abolished by a decree in UAE and replaced by the Dubai International Arbitration Center. Now, when this happened, there became a chaos in the market of is DIAC going to administer all the disputes or not disputes? We were fortunate once to have a London-seated arbitration, but our rules applicable was the new DIAC rules, the Dubai International Arbitration Center rules. So what we had is very interesting ex parte emergency arbitration provisions, very quick and short timeline arbitrations. This was the case where we were able to get a significantly large freezer, you know, in the range of $100 million. We were able to take these freezers then on investigated assets. We were the first ones to enforce interim measures in the DIFC court. DIFC court recently, the Court of Appeals enforced it under the New York Convention, which means you took a London-seated freezer, went to DIFC and started attaching assets on those freezer. We attached assets on those freezers in Singapore. We attached assets on those freezers in Cayman Island. So we were able to take an interim award, get it recognized in three jurisdictions and attach assets. And like every other case, this gentleman had a good interest in the Swiss bank. And we were able to go to Switzerland. And we were able to actually attach proceedings and while the proceeding were going on, get paid out $10 million while litigating with the individual, right? So why this case is very interesting is it was a global project led by Singularity, right? We were lead counsel, English arbitration. We were lead counsel, DIFC courts. We were leading the Singapore leg of it. We were assisted by people in Cayman Island and Switzerland, but we were still, since we did all the parts of it, we were still driving the knowledge, the ideas and everything else. And it's a project which made us realize what we all spoke today, right? This guy is an Indian. Did I chase him in India? You know, there's simply no proceeding till date on this case in India, not a single proceeding. And that brings me to my antidote, right? The fact of the matter is we can proceed in India, and I would love to proceed in India. But our clients have such a bad reputation in their mind of reaching the Indian courts that while they have an international firm who has strong presence in India, they want them not to do anything in India. Because there is this psychological impact of, look, I'm doing so well in all these international jurisdictions. I don't want to take the risk of going to an Indian court. And that's what brings me to the point that if this image is not changed over a period of time, you will start seeing a lot of otherwise disputes which can be litigated in India being litigated outside India, right? And I would say it's a fair choice for the client, right? Why should you spend bad money when you can spend good money and get good reliefs at a global scale? And Indian litigation is not cheap. It sounds cheap up front, but when you see the way money starts going in hearing after hearing and adjournment after adjournment, you end up spending more than a litigation overseas. So I think this is one of the best war stories we've gone through, and we are hoping to come with a lot of landmark decision in it. Several are already out and several will come in the near future. So yeah, this would be a good war story for the day.
Thanks, Prateek. I think from the sounds of it, this is quite a dilemma, because early on, in my career, I saw Indian debtors moving money overseas to conceal them from creditors. Now it sounds like keeping your money in India might be the best form of concealment, because no one wants to touch it. It's too much effort.
No, absolutely. And that's doing that, right? We've been threatened to say, I'm going to move my money to India and you won't be able to do anything about it, right? So it is definitely the exit option. You've seen the big bankruptcies in UAE. The individuals have fled back to India for the reason.
Yeah. Yeah, the world comes full circle. No, thanks for that. Mike, any last war story or notes that you'd like to leave us with?
Not exactly any war stories. I mean, the point about the UAE and, debtors kind of fleeing the UAE and coming to India, I guess my anecdote there is not really that optimistic. But, we've seen so many requests from clients to just kind of like look into an Indian national who's come back to the subcontinent after defaulting in the UAE. But very rarely do we actually work on those projects. People sniff around and they think about it. But then a lot of these banks have so many debtors and the amount of money of any one is not particularly large. And then to even find this person in India, let alone find assets in India, feels to them to be like too much effort. Like they just kind of need to write off their losses, which is a shame, because as Prateek mentioned, we can enforce UAE judgments in India now. But the appetite to really chase after those debtors in India seems to be a bit less. And I would say that, while we do get more requests than we used to actually trace assets in India itself. I was just on the phone this morning with somebody from overseas calling, asking if we could do just that. Still very much the holy grail seems to be to find those assets overseas.
The mansion in Surrey, and the apartment, overlooking Hyde Park. That's what he always wants. That's what everyone
exactly,
always wants.
Exactly. So things are changing, but also staying the same, it seems.
No, thanks. I think that echoes my experience as well, which is, the moment clients come to us with, an Indian angle, their top objective is to find assets overseas. And in many cases now, you know, we are seeing people move back to India. We're seeing assets held by nominees within the country. You know, this used to be in vogue a few years ago, but it's coming back into fashion now. So yeah, watch this space. The world seems to be going around in a full circle.
Mm. Absolutely, absolutely. And I think on a lighter note, right, Instagram and Facebook have been the best investigators to find wealth, right? Your son posing next mm-hmm. to a big Jaguar and your wife posing next to a big bungalow is always a good lead.
Yeah.
I mean, they used to be, Prateek. No one does that anymore.
Come on. Even today, people want to show off. The whole point about making that money is to show it off.
You're working on easier cases than us, is what I'd say. gents, thank you for joining this podcast. Thank you for your time. It's been a pleasure having you, Prateek and Mike.
Likewise. Thanks so much, Akash.
Thank you, Akash. Good to see you both.
Thanks.
If you enjoyed this episode, make sure to subscribe. And be sure to check out our other podcasts as well, such as Decrypt, the podcast making sense of the cyber and technology issues impacting business. For all our analysis and information about services we offer to organizations worldwide, visit controlrisks.com.